When we met 2 weeks back, we have covered up to chapter 4, verse number 14, right?
Okay.
14. So now, let us just recap on these last two verses, 13 and 14. 13 was a very important verse because there we saw the what we call the caste system explained very clearly. And the caste system that Krishna explains in verse 13 is not the caste system that unfortunately we are seeing in India today. What Krishna said is the caste system Chatur Varnyam Maya Shrishtam, meaning this fourfold caste system which was designed by God Himself, is based on Guna Karma. Guna meaning our nature and karma meaning by the type of actions or work that we do. And we discussed that the reason for the caste system is for us to grow out of our desires. So scriptures don't say don't fulfill your desires. As human beings, we have all types of desires to get an education, to get a job, to set up a family, to own possessions. Scriptures don't say don't do all that, but they give us a lifestyle to pursue our desires in a dharmic way and at the same time grow spiritually. So, by going through the fourfold caste system, we are actually pursuing our desires and also growing spiritually. That is the main purpose of the caste system. Thus, you had the division of work by Brahmanas, who are the teachers, who gain knowledge and share knowledge, Kshatriyas, who are the protectors and defenders of law and order, and at the same time, their administration and politics, Vaishyas, who are the business people, and Sudras, who are the labor force. So by choosing a profession according to our nature, we are serving society, satisfying our desires, and at the same time also growing spiritually. So this conversion from material desires to spiritual awakening can be attained by living a life prescribed by the scriptures. And how should we have that attitude of action whenever we carry out all our duties? That Krishna gave himself as an example in verse number 14. From this we learn that we also as jivas take many types of incarnations. We come after from one life to another life. We also take different forms and lives also. Similarly, when God also comes down to earth, He also takes different incarnations, different types of bodies, different types of incarnation He takes. And Krishna says, He gives Himself as an example how one should go about discharging your duties and responsibilities. He said in verse number 14, Namam karmani limpanti. First of all, He says, actions do not taint me. Actions do not affect me. What He means by this is that actions do not cause any agitations, frustrations, anger, disappointments. And what is the reason that actions do not affect the Lord? He says, because name karma phales praha. Karma phal, phal means the fruit of your action, that is what troubles and disturbs all of us. We are always worried, if I do this, what will happen? Will I get something? Will I not get something? So Krishna says, this praha, this desire or this hankering, spraha means there is a hankering for the results, for the future. Krishna says, I do not get affected by it. That means if we also follow the same attitude in our lives, perform all our actions, what do we surrender? What do we surrender? The fruits of our actions. Surrender the results of your actions. And why should we surrender the results of our actions? What is the reason? Or rather, why should we surrender the results of our actions?
Because
First of all, we have to understand, are the results really in our control? We can set an objective, we can set a plan, we can have a, what we call goal in life, but whether we achieve that goal depends on so many factors. We only play one part of that factor. There are many other factors, the environment, the people around us, our past karmas, everything can affect the outcome of the action. So again, have a goal, work to that goal, but if you don't achieve that goal, thank Lord, whether you get it or you don't get it, surrender that result to God. Let Him decide for us what is good for us. So whether you obtain or don't obtain, don't have that disappointment. Analyze the situation and move ahead and thank God for whatever is given you. So Krishna says, therefore, I am not affected by the hankering of the results. And we also, if we adapt the same attitude, we will find our mind is more calm. We are able to discharge our duties. There is no agitation. There is no frustration in it. Now we come to today's verse, verse number 15, where Krishna carries on to discuss about this right attitude of action. And here he says, what is the secret knowledge? Again, Krishna points to the very ancient source of this knowledge. In the very beginning of this chapter, Krishna had said that this knowledge about right way to do our action is not something new. This has already been given in our Vedas. The Vedas have told us what is the right way to do our duties and perform all our actions. So here also Krishna is saying, Purve, the word Purve, which appears in the second line of verse 15, means ancient people, people who came before you, thousands of years before you. They also have been following the same advice from the Vedas. There's nothing new. The Gita is just a condensation of the Vedas. All the knowledge of the Gita is repeated, comes from the Vedas. So before the Gita, only Vedas were available. And the ancient people, Purve, and who were these people? He says they were not ordinary people. They were Mumukshubi. Mumukshubi means they were seekers of moksha. They were seekers of liberation. They desired moksha. That was their main goal. Because the Vedas gave us four goals in life. What are the four goals? Kama, Artha, Dharma, and Moksha. Moksha is said to be the ultimate goal. And these people kept Moksha as the ultimate goal and they went through life doing dharmic works, gaining karma, satisfying their desires, gaining artha, gaining all types of possessions, but they never, what we call, all their desires and possessions were on the platform of dharma and thus they reached Moksha. So they were ancient people who had Moksha as their goal. And evam jnatva, he says here in the very first line, evam jnatva, when they gained this knowledge from the scriptures, what did they do? They did not run away from their responsibilities and problems in life. Like Arjuna, he had the knowledge, but he was also running away from his duties and responsibilities. So he says they remained as a householder, and this is very important for us to understand. Because the scriptures do not force us to take the life of sannyas. You can also reach moksha. Krishna is telling us here, the ancient people reach moksha how? By doing their duties, not running away from their duties. So, we can also attain moksha by remaining as a householder. That is, if you want to take up sannyas, it's an option. But you don't have to necessarily take up sannyas. So, he says, these ancient people, the householders, and what did they do? Karma kritam. Karma kritam means they perform all their duties. That is the most important thing. They did not run away. They faced all their challenges in life and perform all their duties. And what was their nature? Inner peace. Total detachment. So Arjuna, what Lord is telling here, Arjuna, you also can gain that same knowledge, apply it into your daily life, do all your duties, remain as a householder and don't ever entertain any thoughts of sannyas, which is what Arjuna wanted to do. He thought by running away from his duties, taking up sannyas, he can attain a peace of mind. But Krishna is telling him, no, even by doing your duty with the right attitude, you can have that same peace of mind. Tasmat, he uses the word tasmat here, if you see in the third line. Tasmat means therefore, tvam, you, kuru karmai, you resort to action, you do your duty. The very same action that was done with the right attitude by your ancient people, by those who came before you. And that's why sometimes we get confused, because when we take up the study of the Gita, we wonder, how can this knowledge which was given to Arjuna 5000 years ago, what is the relevance of that knowledge to our life today? Isn't it? Life was different thousands of years ago and life is different today. So how can that knowledge be relevant? How can that apply to us? But we fail to understand that the problems that afflicted mankind thousands of years ago are the same problems that afflict us today also. The situation may be different, the lifestyles may be different, but the problems were all the same. And what is the problem that afflicted Arjuna on the battlefield? There were four main problems that Arjuna went through, which we are also all going through in one way or the other. So what are the four problems that were explained to us in chapter 1 and 2? Can you recall the problems? The same problem that afflicted Arjuna, the same things that are afflicting mankind today. What are the problems? Attachment was there, but attachment created what problem? Attachment is the source. But what did it create, the problem?
Fear.
What else? Sorry? Desire? What else?
Delusions.
Sorrow. The main problems that disturb guilt. The main problems that disturb our mind, which Arjuna went through, were four problems. One was stress. One was tension. Different a bit. Stress causing tension. Then he went into depression. And then finally, thoughts of suicide. Thoughts of suicide. So there's stress, there's tension, there's depression, and there is thoughts of suicide. Now you say, where is this? Where does it mention in chapter 1 and chapter 2? Where do we see the stress? Where do we see stress? No, that's not stress here. When do we see the stress? In chapter 1, if you look at verse number 20, 20, 21 and 22, sorry, 20 and 21, chapter 1, verse number 20, 21 and 22. You can see his stress already building up. Page number 11. What does he say there? He tells Krishna what? Take my chariot in between the two armies, so I can carefully observe all the warriors whom I have to fight. There was already stress in him. Now, understand one thing. Arjuna was a mere soldier. He was not a commander. He did not have to worry who has come to fight or who he has to fight with. All he had to do was take the order and fight. Yet there was stress in his mind already. I want to see, you know, don't we have the stress? I want to know what is going to happen here. I want to know this. I want to know that. There is continuous stress in our mind. So here first Arjuna faced stress. Then when came tension? Look at chapter 2. Chapter 2 verse number 4. Yes. Then came tension. Chapter 2 verse number 4. Page 26. What did he say? Oh Krishna, how am I going to kill all these people? Tension. Who are these people? People whom I love and respect and worship, my gurus, my grandfather, my beloved relatives. So, we think Arjuna didn't have problem. Today, if
we kill, we want to hit somebody or you want to harm somebody who is a stranger whom you are just angry with, is very easy. But if I ask you to kill your own relative or best friend, would you be able to do it? Can you imagine the type of tension that Arjuna was going through? Who am I going to shoot arrows into? He says in verse number 5, Gurun ahatva hi mahanu bhavan. They are great people, mahanu. They are people whom I admire, respect. And you expect me to shoot arrows into them? So from stress became tension when he realized the type of work he has to do. Then, where is depression? Where is depression? Depression is when he puts his bow and arrow down, and especially if you see in verse number 1 of chapter 2, page 24, we can see the signs of depression in Arjuna. If you look at the second line of verse 1, Asru Purna Kulekshanam Ikshanam Eyes. What was wrong with his eyes? Purna, not only tears, but Purna, full, bursting with tears. Ashru means tears, Purna means full. His eyes were bursting with tears. So isn't that a sign of depression? Because many people express depression in different ways. Some people get depressed, what they do? They go and sit in a corner. Some people cry like a baby. Some people just, you can see it on their faces, that they are in a state of depression. Arjuna expressed his troubled mind openly by crying out, full of tears. And finally came the last resort when thoughts of suicide came in his mind. Where is that mentioned in the Gita? Thoughts of suicide came in his mind. That's why when we read the Gita, we must try to understand it. Because these are the problems of mankind. And they are the same problems that afflict Arjuna, that are afflicting us today. Thoughts of suicide, look at chapter 1, verse 46, page 22. He said what? It would be better if I am slain unarmed and unresisting in battle. Meaning what? I am willing to give up my life. By giving up my life, all my problems will disappear. Isn't it? Isn't that what suicidal tendencies are? With death, all my problems are solved. So here Arjuna is saying, I'll throw my weapons down, let them come and even kill me, I will not fight. That means what? I'm prepared to give up my life. I'm prepared to give up my life and then all my problems will be over. So you can see the type of psychological problems that Arjuna went through until he didn't know what to do. And Arjuna's problem can be summarized in one word. In chapter 2, verse number 7. That very important verse. Chapter 2, verse number 7. One word in this summarizes the whole of Arjuna's problem. And that word is Kripana. Kripana, the very first word. Karpana, Kripana means a miser. Now, miserly attitude. Who is a miser? What is the definition of a miser? Confused, yeah. So how do you define a miser? Can a poor man be a miser? Can a poor man be a miser? Can? How can a poor man be a miser? What has he got to give away? He's got nothing to give away. So what I'm saying, a poor man who's got just enough to support himself. But who do we normally call a miser? A rich man, isn't it? Who has so much and yet doesn't want to give even a little. So, what we are saying here, that in society, a miser is one who has everything but doesn't want to give away. Similarly, aren't we also misers? How are we misers? How is Arjuna a miser? How are we a miser? How are we defined as misers also? You and me. gifted by God with what? This human form. We have been gifted by God with the intellect to gain knowledge. But whatever we have been gifted, do we use it? So we don't even use it. Aren't we the most biggest misers? We have such a rich resource at our disposal. It is not that we don't have. We have books, we have gurus, everything is provided to us. But what do we do with all the treasures that we have? This intellect that we have, books that we have, gurus that we have. What do? We don't even utilize them also. So in that way, scripture says, we are the greatest misers who are not using what we have been treasured with, what we have been gifted with. We don't use it. And what do the scriptures say about misers, do you know? About people who are kripana, who don't use the very gifts that God has given us. Correct. So what is the destination of misers? What do the scriptures say about such misers? He says, the scriptures say, misers are literally those people who have committed suicide. Atmahatya. What do you mean by misers have literally committed suicide? This is what the scriptures are saying. They are saying those who don't use the intellect, those who don't use this human form to reach God, to attain God, are misers. And misers are those who have committed suicide. Meaning what? How? When somebody commits suicide, means what? It is a waste of human life. That means you do not appreciate this gift that you have been given. So you do not deserve another human life in the next birth. So you have wasted this golden opportunity of attaining this human life, because only by attaining this human life can you attain God. But if you have misabused and not used what you have been treasured with, then you do not deserve. So you, what the scriptures say, you have literally committed suicide. You have wasted one human birth. And you do not know when again you will get the opportunity to attain another human birth. So that's why here Krishna is saying, the ancient people, knowing means not just having knowledge, but it means putting the knowledge into practice. So what Krishna is telling Arjuna, why don't you follow the same path that your ancient people, and who were Arjuna's ancient ancestors? They were not sannyasis, they were not swamis, they were not renunciates. Who were they? They were kings also who ruled a kingdom. They were family people who had families to look after. So here Krishna is telling us that these ancient people, ancestors of Arjuna, were not sannyasis. They were ordinary human beings who were householders. They also attained this knowledge and they attained moksha. So he's telling Arjuna, you don't have to become a sannyasi to get peace of mind. By doing your duty, you can also attain liberation. Just follow the teachings of the scriptures, which is all time tested. And again, mentioning ancestors means telling what? This knowledge has been tested by people before you. It is not new knowledge. It is knowledge that has worked for people before. So why don't you just follow that same advice also?
Here the word kapina is translated as coward.
Cowardly, miserly. Actually, the word karpana comes from kripana, meaning a miserly attitude. Miserly attitude. Because that's what he says. He says, my very overbeing is overpowered by sense of miserliness or cowardliness. Now, when he says cowardliness means what? What is he, Arjuna? He is a soldier. How can he be having attitudes of cowardliness? And yet he is saying, my understanding is confused as to duty. I know my duty is to fight, but I do not know why I am throwing down my weapons and not fighting. So he is in a state of confusion. He is not using the strength that he has to fight, neither is he using the intellect to understand how to get out of the situation. But most important, what he did was he surrendered to Krishna. That is very important. So when we are also in a state of confusion, that's why I told you before, this verse is a beautiful verse for us to recite also every day. So for us also to clear our mind, sometimes we are in a state of confusion, we do not know what to do, recite this verse and surrender to Krishna. So therefore Krishna is saying, you cannot escape karma. There is no way you can escape your duties. If you run away from your duties and responsibilities, one way or the other, your karma is going to bring you back again to the same situation. So instead of running away, do your duties, but have the right attitude. That's why we must understand karma is external, attitude is internal. So knowledge of right action has been made available to all humans right at the beginning of creation in the Vedas, and now it has been repeated back to us in a condensed form in this Bhagavad Gita also. So that's what Krishna is saying, use this knowledge and you can attain moksha. So now we come to verse number 16. Now, in verse number 16 now, if we recall one important point, earlier in verse number 9, Krishna had told us the two very important sadhanas in order for us to reach moksha. So two things Krishna said you must know. One is Divyam Janma, my divine birth. First, understand the true nature of God. What is the true nature of God? Most of us associate God with a form, having taken birth. But what is the real true nature of God? What is the real true nature of God?
Love.
Okay, you can say love, you can say compassion. But what is the real true nature of God? We associate God with a manifested form. But what is the true nature of God? Unmanifested, beyond this manifested stage. So He is the all-pervading consciousness. He is everywhere. So Krishna said, first of all, understand my true nature, my highest nature. And that we can only understand through how? Through knowledge. So that means what he is saying, first gain knowledge. Jnana Yoga is very important for us to study the scriptures and understand the true nature of God, because that is our ultimate destination. So then once we understand that the true nature of God is all-pervading consciousness, what is the second understanding we come to? This all-pervading consciousness is also within me also. And then we come to the understanding that this consciousness is my real identity. So there is Brahman, which is the all-pervading consciousness. That consciousness is the same within me, which is called Atma. Atma is the same as Brahman. The air inside the bottle is the same as the air outside the bottle. There is no difference. We just call this Atma, we call that Brahman. So A is Atma, B is Brahman, C is consciousness. A equals B equals C. There is no difference. All are one and the same. So first of all, Krishna says, understand my highest nature. Number two, he says, Divyam Karma, understand my divine actions. When God takes a form, how does He discharge all His duties? What is the right attitude that we must cultivate? So these two are very important things for us to understand. That how God performs His action, He is not affected. In the similar way, we also must perform our actions with the right attitude. So now here Krishna is saying that to understand what is right action also is a big problem, because it is not easy to understand. Sometimes we see people doing good things and we think that is right action, but that is not necessarily right action. As I explained to you before, one person can give a donation for 500 ringgit, but the attitude is with ego, with arrogance, I give 500 ringgit. Another person can give a donation for 1 ringgit, but there is only humility in such a person. But for us, when we see outside, from outward, external, it appears that the first person is doing a great duty. But in terms of karma, who is doing the best duty? The first person or the second person? Second person. So action is not easy to understand. So what Krishna is saying here, in verse 16, he uses the word Kavayo. Kavayo means great thinkers, philosophers. those people who study the scriptures and who are the great thinkers, he says, Kavayo api mohita. Kavayo means the great thinkers, api, even mohita, even they were confused. They were also confused by what? Kim karma. What is action? Kim means what? Karma means action. What is the real proper definition of karma? We must understand this. Kim akarma. Akarma means if karma is action, when you add a in front of that, it becomes inaction. So when we say akarma, the scriptures say inaction, what do you mean by inaction? Does it mean if I am just sitting down like that, is it called inaction? Is that what is called inaction? If you see somebody sitting down meditating, is that called inaction? Why? He is? What is he doing?
Meditating.
The mind is running all over the world. Right? So inaction, you might look at that person and say he is at peace and calm, but his mind is full of trouble, problems. So inaction also we must understand, what does the scriptures mean when they say akarma? So these two things Krishna says we must understand. Therefore Krishna is saying, Te karma pravakshami. Pravakshami means I shall tell you. And when he adds the word pra means I will tell you in detail. I will tell you very clearly what is the meaning of action and inaction. And what happens, Krishna says, when I give you this knowledge, when you know what is action, when you know what is inaction, he says, yach jnatva, knowing which, when you grasp this knowledge, mokshase, you will be free. See, the word mokshase appears in the last line. Mokshase, you will become free from what? Asubat. Shubha means good, ashubha means bad, evil. So what is the evil? What does he mean by evil? He says if you know what is the meaning of action and inaction and apply this in your life, you will be free from evil. What type of evil? What does he mean by evil here? Exactly. What is it that causes us all kinds of pain and sorrow, agitation, depression, anger, right? All that causes us pain in our mind. That is what it is called evil. So that's why sin is not something that you go to hell and suffer. Sin is right now on earth we are suffering because our mind is in that troubled state. So knowledge is very important to understand. Krishna says, attain this knowledge, apply this knowledge, you will be free from all the agitations of the mind. You will have peace of mind. You will be able to carry out all your duties without pain, worry, frustration. So gaining knowledge is not easy. Sometimes we think, what we look at action looks so straightforward. We think we are doing good things, but we don't really understand what is the definition of right action. This is what Krishna is trying to give us. So intricate is this knowledge. And that's why nowadays people want to find very fast, they want information and knowledge. And there is a mantra, you know, nowadays. If you want quick knowledge, there is a mantra you can recite. You can all get quick knowledge. You want that mantra? Fast and easy, right? Everybody wants fast and easy. They don't want to go through all the problems. So I give you one quick mantra, you can get knowledge. And as every mantra that you recite, you must have the ending with what? Normally you recite Om something something, then Namaha, right? So this mantra also you recite Om something something, Namaha. So the mantra goes like this. Om Google Namaha. Means what? Switch on your computer, tap into Google, you get all the knowledge. Instant knowledge, isn't it? But to gain this knowledge, 700 verses have been given to us to make us understand properly what is right action. We must get a grasp of this. Otherwise, we will be doing things but not in the right way. So now here in verse number 17, Krishna says, so intricate is this knowledge that three things we must understand.
So the word bodhavyam appears here. You see, bodhavyam appears in the first line, in the second line, in the third line. Bodhavyam here means what is the truth, what is the real truth about three things you must really understand. And what is it? Karmani api bodhavyam. What is the truth about karma or action? So one is karma or action. Then he says second line, bodhavyam cha vikarmanaha. Vikarmanaha means prohibited action. What are the actions that you must drop? What are the actions that you should not do? That also you should know. And the third thing is, in the third line, akarmana bodhavyam. What is the truth about inaction? That means three things. Karma, action. Vikarma, prohibited actions which should be dropped. And akarma, what is inaction. All these three things you must understand very clearly. Then, when you perform your actions with this knowledge, then only you will be free of all the disturbances, anxiety, depression, etc. And therefore, Krishna says, in the last line, karmana gati gahana. Gati means the nature or the path of karmana, karma action, is very gahana. Gahana means it's very deep. It is not very easy to understand. It requires a lot of contemplation on the very meaning. That's why so many books, so many lectures are given just on karma alone, just to understand what is karma. How many volumes of books have been written? So much of in-depth knowledge has been given to us. It is not easy to understand. Now, just to give you a simple example of action, a simple scenario. Supposing before the Mahabharata war started and Duryodhan were to go and see Krishna. Okay, this is just an example. Supposing before the Mahabharata war had started and Duryodhan went to see Krishna and he says to Krishna, Krishna, this war is very terrible. Lot of people are going to die. How many people died in the war? In the Mahabharata war? Only 10 survived. Only 10 people survived. How many people died in the war? How many millions? 3 million people. There were 11 battalions. 7 on the side of the Pandavas, 11 on the side of the Kauravas. 3 million people perished on the battlefield. Such a devastating battle it was. Now, had Duryodhan came to his senses and gone to see Krishna and told him, this is a terrible war, many people are going to lose their lives, let us call off this war, let us have peace. What do you think Krishna would have said? What do you think Krishna would have said? Will he agree or disagree? No, he'll agree, right? He'll say, what a wonderful proposition, let us call off this war. Okay? Now, Arjuna did the same thing, right? What did Arjuna say? Why should we fight this war? Krishna, millions of people will die. So many families will be destroyed. Didn't he say that in chapter 1?
Yes.
Let us call off this war, Krishna. What did Krishna tell him?
Yes.
Don't stop. Go and fight. Duryodhan wants to stop the war. He says it's okay. It's dharma. Arjuna wants to stop the war. He says it is adharma. Two people want to do the same action. One is dharmic, one is adharmic. So just looking at action is not easy to understand. So what Krishna is saying here, you need a right guru, you need the right scriptures, you need a lot of contemplation just to understand this. So now, to make it easy for us, in verse number 18, he gives a very simple explanation of that. Already telling us it's difficult to understand, but then in verse 18, he gives us a very simple explanation. So I'll just read you the English text first. What does he say? He who sees inaction in action and action in inaction is wise among men. He is a yogi who has accomplished all actions. Simple. Telling us it's complicated and then giving us another complicated verse. So here actually, scriptures here are using, or rather Krishna is using a language of contradiction. We must understand why is this language of contradiction introduced in this verse.
what is the purpose that such a confusing terms and conditions are used here? Why not just simply tell us? Instead, he is going to tell us in such a way that really confuses us. So why is language of contradiction? See action in inaction. See inaction in action. Why make it so confusing? So whenever there is this kind of verses that come, very tricky verses or very confusing verses, the reason is that this is very important, and therefore the way the knowledge is presented is in that way. So that means we use our intellect to really think about it carefully. You see or not? That means if you really analyze a verse, you really understand it, you will never forget it. Rather than if I straightforward I give you the knowledge, you can forget it in a second. But if you use your own intellect to analyze it, to understand it deeply, you will never forget this. So that's why sometimes the verses are given to us to make us think deeper, right? So it is not very easy to understand, it is very subtle. Action is very subtle. Because why? It is at physical level, it is at mental level, and it is at verbal level. When we talk about karma, we are talking about three levels. Physical actions that we do is karma. Mental thoughts that we think, that is also karma. Words that we use, that is also karma. Action is at all three levels. That's why it's not easy to understand. So, scriptures also, as I said, they give you very deep knowledge about it. So now, like for example, there's a story I read that one man was searching for a job, and he went to a music school where they teach music. And he went hunting for a job, and finally he came to this music school. And then the manager interviewed him. He says, "Can you play any musical instrument?" He says, "No, I cannot play." He says, "Can you sing?" He says, "No, I cannot sing." "Then what can you do?" So at that moment, there was a person conducting an orchestra in a music school. You know, what does the conductor do? Right? He waves his hand. He said, "That I can do, very easy." Meaning what? He just saw him waving his hands, he thought it is simple. But when a conductor waves his hands, is it that simple? The actions have got some very deep meaning also there. So by just looking at action, we cannot just simply analyze. That's why here, even the scriptures tell us in very deep ways. And there is a saying in our scriptures, that's why, you see, our time also is limited. We don't have so much time to analyze. So we really have to spend what you call a lot of time to know this knowledge, because it is very important. Whatever action we do is going to be the future of our next birth, where we go, where we are born, in which direction. All that is going to be determined by our action. So if we don't understand what is the right action, we are creating our own destiny. Now, what does this verse imply when Krishna says, "He who sees inaction in action and action in inaction is wise among men"? What does this very first line imply? He who sees inaction in action and action in inaction, he is wise among men. What does the very first line imply? That means what? If you don't see this, you are not wise. Correct or not? Because he is saying only the wise people see. When he says see means what? What does he mean by see? Understand. That means you have to use your intellect. And if you recall in chapter 2 verse 11, when Krishna gave his very first instruction to Arjuna, he said something about wise men. What did he say about wise men in chapter 2 verse 11? If you go back to chapter 2 verse 11. Wise men do not grieve over dead or living people. Meaning what? Wise men do not grieve about the past and do not grieve about the future. Wise people are those who analyze what is the situation and they rise to the action. They don't sit down crying. So, that means what he's saying,
if you do not understand what is the nature of action and inaction, you will be grieving through your whole life. Right? So, do not grieve if you understand. If you understand this knowledge, you will not grieve. And the second reason why these verses also are very, in a very confusing way, there is a mythological tale about Vyasa and Ganesha. You might know this story. I think most of you have heard this story. How many of you have heard this story? Only the children have heard. Kumara. But the story goes like this in Mahabharata. That when Vyasa wanted to dictate Mahabharata, right? You all heard the story, right? So do you want me to go into it? Okay, for those who do not know, when Vyasa wanted to dictate the Mahabharata, he needed somebody to write. So he went to Ganesha, and Ganesha said, I will write as you dictate, but I have one condition. You must continuously dictate. If you stop dictating, I will stop writing and I will not pick up the pen again. So you must not stop. Continuously go on dictating. So Vyasa got worried because he said, I have to also think. Maybe something I want to say, I have to stop and think. So he threw another condition to Ganesha. I agree with your condition, but I also have a condition. If you don't understand what I am saying, you cannot write it down. So you must understand first before you write down. So why Vyasa suddenly had to throw verses like this to confuse Ganesha? So by the time Ganesha stopped to think, Vyasa also had time to think about the next verse. So that's a mythological story that also relates to confusing verses in the Gita. Okay, now let us see what is this action and inaction. And there are two ways to look at it. One is the philosophical angle and one is the practical angle. So what is the philosophical angle? When we look at this verse philosophically, we have to go back to the teachings of the Vedas or Vedanta, what we call Vedanta. And Vedanta tells us that we as a human being, we have two personalities. What are the two personalities which we have discussed before? All of us are made up of two parts, two personalities. What are the two personalities? One is called matter, prakriti, and one is purusha or consciousness, right? So one is matter and one is consciousness. All of us are composed of these two elements. To simply understand it, consciousness is like electricity, matter is the bulb. So we are a combination of electricity and bulb, or matter and consciousness. Now, since we are composed of two components, we must understand what is the difference between these two also. So what is the difference between, to understand the difference between consciousness and matter, we can, the scriptures normally give a simple example of clay and pot. If you can understand what is the difference between clay and pot, you can also understand what's the difference between consciousness and matter. Now, what is the difference? Number one, clay in the scriptures, especially in the Mundaka Upanishad, it explains very beautifully about this difference between clay and pot. So in the Mundaka Upanishad, one difference is given as clay is the cause. Cause in Sanskrit is called karanam. Karanam means cause. Pot is the effect. Right? Pot is called karyam or effect. So clay is the cause, pot is the effect. Okay. Now, when we have this knowledge, we understand one is cause, one is effect. What do we know now? We know that before the pot existed, what existed? Clay was there. Clay existed before the pot, right? And when the pot is broken, what still exists?
Clay
still exists. So clay exists before the pot, and when the pot is there, and even when the pot is broken, clay always exists. That means what do we conclude? The cause is, now the first difference is what? If clay exists before the pot, while the pot is there, and when the pot is broken, now what is the first thing we can conclude now?
clay is
consciousness,
which is nityam, which always exists. And pot is anityam, which means it is subject to arrival and departure. That is the first difference. That means consciousness existed before this body. It exists while the body is there, and when the body perishes, consciousness will continue to exist. So, the cause will always be nityam. It will always continue to exist. The effect is anityam. It is subject to arrival and departure. And this is the relationship between consciousness and matter. Now, the technical name to consciousness in the scriptures is given as Atma, that we all know. And matter is called Anatma, A-N-A-T-M-A, Anatma. So you have Atma and Anatma. Okay? Second difference. Again, look at pots and clay. Pots can be many, different sizes, shapes, colors, but clay is only one type. Therefore, cause is only one, karanam is only ekam, is one. Karyam, the effect, is many. There can be many types of bodies, shapes, sizes and color, but the Atman in all of us is only one. Just like clay is of only one nature, but the pots are of different shapes, sizes and color. So that's the second difference we can understand. Third, karanam, which is the cause, the clay, has an independent existence. That means what? Its existence does not depend on the pot. Whereas, can pot exist without clay? No. So, what does it say here? That you can have clay, but not necessarily there's a pot. But in no way can there be a pot existing without the clay. Right? In the same way, body needs Atman to exist. For the body to function, to have life, it needs the presence of Atman. But Atman is conscious without the body. It has life of its own. Okay? And the fourth one to understand, when the pot is broken, when the pot is destroyed, what happens to the clay? It still exists. So similarly, when the body perishes, the Atman still exists. It doesn't mean that because Atman is in the body perishes, Atman also perishes. Body perishes, Atman still exists. So now if we can understand the difference between clay and pot, we can relate this same understanding to Atma and Anatma. Okay? Now, second thing also, I'm just giving you a little bit of background what the Upanishads say also about this relationship between Atma and Anatma. Another thing which is important for us to understand is that there is what we call, for all anything to be created, right? Just like when a pot is created, you need two very important things. One is called intelligent cause. In Sanskrit, it is called nimitta karanam. N-I-M-I-T-A, nimitta karanam. So what do we mean by intelligent cause? Supposing you want to create a pot. Who is the intelligent cause? The potter. Right? If I want to create a wooden table, who is the intelligent cause? The carpenter. So, to create anything, one, you need an intelligent cause, nimitta karanam. Second, what do you need? You need a material, the raw matter, which is called upadana karanam. U-P-A-D-A-N-A. Upadana karanam. These are technical words used in the Upanishads. Now, therefore, to create a wooden table, you need a carpenter and you need wood, right? And are carpenter and wood one and the same? Don't worry, it's not a trick question. Are carpenter and wood one and the same? No, the carpenter has got to go and take wood to create a table, okay? Now, come back to the same thing, to the creation of this world. Who created the world? God created the world. God is the intelligent cause, right? Where did the matter come from? Where did the material come from? We say to create anything, somebody needs to get some material to go and create. Anything in creation, right? You need an intelligent cause and material cause. Now just think, to create the world, God is the intelligent cause. Where is the material cause?
Huh?
Where did the material come from? We are composed of what? No, at the beginning there was only God. That's what the scriptures say. Only God was there in the beginning, right? So we are composed of five, what do you call it, elements, right? Ether, air, fire, water, earth. Now where did all this come from?
From His creation.
In the beginning, nothing existed except God. So where did the material come from?
His
correct. Well, where did Prakriti come from? Because that's why you must understand. Like you are saying that wood came from the carpenter. That's what you are saying now.
No, that is for the carpenter.
Correct. So, or a goldsmith creates gold. Where did the gold come from? Did it come from him? So, okay, you are saying the material came from God. Is there an example in the world that you can give me that can explain this? Is there an example? Anything you take in the world, to create anything, you need an intelligent cause and a material cause. Is there any example in the world, you say the material came from God, can you give an example from the world?
Huh?
Caterpillar produces silk. Produces a very good example. So the scriptures give us three examples to help us to understand how can the matter also come from within. Example is one example, like a spider spins a web. It does not need to go outside to take the material. It comes from within. So what the scriptures are trying to tell us, it is possible. There are practical examples in the world. Like a spider spins the web. Third, second example, like hair grows from the skin. Right? The material comes also within. Third example, like a tree springs from a seed. So, then it is a possibility we can see in nature that not necessarily everything we have to go and take the material from outside. The material can be produced also. Similarly, God projects Himself as the world. We have to understand this. Very important. Cause is a very important point in the Upanishads. Cause is always in the effect. Cause is always in the effect. What do I mean? Wooden table, the cause is what? Wood. Wood is in the effect, is in the wooden table. Gold is in the ornaments, means what? Cause is in the effect. Now, if God is the cause of the world, therefore, where is God in the world?
Everywhere.
He is everywhere. He is in the world, He is in the effect. So, very important to understand, cause is always in the effect. Therefore, God did not create the world, but He also permeates the world. Also. He is available everywhere. Just like we can understand, gold is in all ornaments, clay is in all pots, similarly, God also is the available in the world. And second thing we must understand, although the effect is destroyed, we say if God is in the world is eventually destroyed, we must understand that God is not destroyed. Where do we got this example? When clay is in the pot is destroyed, clay still exists. So although God is in the world is destroyed, but God still exists. God is not subject to change. Okay? So these things we must understand. So now we understand that we are a mixture of two, Atma and Anatma. Now, what is the next question you have to ask? If you are a mixture of two and you understand the difference now between the two, cause and effect, now what is the next thing you have to understand? I am made of two components. I know the difference between these two. What is the next question I should ask myself?
How does the two become one?
How does the two become one? What else? You have, who are you in reality? Are you this perishable matter or are you the imperishable consciousness? Which is your real reality?
Mm-hmm.
Because one is perishable, subject to arrival and departure, one is imperishable, not subject to arrival and departure. So you have to ask yourself now. Because if you accept that you are perishable, means what? You are subject to birth and death. If you accept that you are imperishable nature, which means what? You are eternal. There is no fear of death. Where is there death for something that is imperishable? So, this is what the scriptures are trying to tell us. That you are the higher I. You are the imperishable higher I, the consciousness. But the problem is, every day we get up, what happens? We look in the mirror, what do we see? We see that body, the physical body, and we identify with this. So now, the only way is for us to constantly engage in inquiry. From birth to now, we have been brought up to be told that we are this body. We have this name, we have this body, we have this nature. But now, through inquiry, we have to start understanding our higher nature. So just like the story is told in Mahabharata, Karna, when he met Mother Kunti, you all know the story of Mahabharata. Kunti told him she had 6 sons. Correct? Kunti told him she had 6 sons. But Karna knew that she had only 5 sons. So he asked her, where did this 6th son come from? Who is this 6th fellow? Because I know you have only got 5 sons. So Kunti said, would you like to meet the 6th child? He says, okay, who is he? She says, Saha Tvam Asi. That you are. Now, what does it mean? It means that, same thing the scriptures are telling us, Tat Tvam Asi, that Atma, that consciousness, that is your real identity. So similarly, like Karna, he didn't have to travel somewhere to find out who is the 6th child. He didn't have to physically travel. What did he need to know that he is the 6th child? Just different thinking, just different knowledge. To understand that I am that 6th child. So to understand this Atma, we don't have to travel anywhere. It is just knowledge, it is that understanding, the realization of who you really are. You are not this physical body. In reality, you are that higher consciousness, that eternal consciousness. And what is the nature of this consciousness? Number one, it is a life matter that enlivens the body. Number two, it is a witness. It does not interfere in any of your actions. It is not responsible for what the body does, for what the mind thinks, for what the words that you speak. Consciousness is always a witness. So these are the two very important things that you have to understand. Now, therefore, if we identify ourselves as this perishable, limited body, or do we identify ourselves as the eternal consciousness? So now we come back to this wording when he says, Karmani akarma ya pashet. A wise person sees, pashet, what? Action, inaction, inaction. Now, where is inaction, where is action? Now that you understand that you are composed of two components, Atma and Anatma, where is the inaction, where is the action? Inaction is Atma. Action is in the body. So one who sees that I am of the higher nature, I am the Atma in this body, is the one who understands Atma is always of nature of inaction. You are not doing anything because the Atma is only a witness, it is only a consciousness. In spite of the body carrying on all the actions, you realize that you are the witness of all the actions. That is seeing inaction in action. And what about seeing action in inaction? What about seeing action in action? Even when there is no action going on, yet all the seed of action exists also in the mind. There is also all the activity existing in the mind. Even though there is no action going on, the seed of activity, it is just like this. When you go to sleep, all your desires, your plans, your ambitions, all your thought, what happens to all that? it just goes into rest. When you get up the next morning, all your thoughts, your desires, everything awakens. So while there is inaction, there is activity still going on in the mind. Now, that is, if we look at it in the same way like how we see a cinema projection. The cinema screen is always in action. But on the screen we see the projection of all the activity going on. Drama is going on, there is crying, there is laughing, there is all kinds of things going on. But the screen remains actionlessness. That is called inaction in action. So it depends on us, on what level do we see ourselves. Do we see ourselves as the Atma while all actions are going on? Our mind is at peace, we are not troubled. Or do we identify ourselves with this body and get entangled in all our actions? So that's why he says a wise person always looks upon all the actions as I am the Atma, I am the witness, I am the consciousness of everything that is going on. Therefore, what is causing the actions of the body? Why is the body acting this way? Why is the mind thinking this way? Why am I talking this way? If Atma is not responsible, then who is responsible? What is it that is driving the body? The gunas are driving the body. Consciousness is the weakness. The three gunas in us are influencing all your actions. The reason why you are here is because of your sattvic guna. It has nothing to do with Atma, because Atma is the weakness. So we have to understand the relationship between this action and inaction. Now that is to understand on the philosophical level, right? And we can experience this if we understand that we are the consciousness witnessing all our actions. Our mind can experience peace. You can experiment yourself. Every time you get into a situation, if you identify yourself as the body, you will see what is the nature of your mind. If somebody is scolding you, somebody is insulting you, if you accept that you are the body, what happens to your mind? Immediately you're agitated. But if you are able to do this by stepping aside and just watching everything as a witness, just watch the nature of your mind. It is, if this person is insulting this person and you are witnessing, what is the nature of your mind? You are not affected at all. But the minute that person turns around and insults you, what happens to you? So that's the difference between your witness and non-witness. And this peace of mind we are all witnessing. We all of us are witnessing at one time. What is that time? All of us witness this. When you are asleep. Isn't it? All your worries, all your troubles, everything that you have, when you go into deep sleep, what is the state of your mind? You are at peace. But where is this peace coming from? You see, when we are active in the world, when we are awake, we get all kinds of happiness through our senses. Something we see nice, something nice we hear, something we taste through our senses, we can attain happiness. Right? Through our senses, through our mind, or we read something through our intellectual knowledge, we can attain happiness. When you are asleep, your senses, are they working? Is your mind working? Is your intellect working? Where is this peace coming? Where is this sense of happiness and peace coming from? It's coming from the Atma. Because that is the time you are the most closest to the Atma. So understand, we are all, we can experience this sense of peace, which is within, not external. But only if we understand how to handle all the transactions of our life from the position of Atma or from the position of Anatma. So when we meet next week, we will look at the more practical angle. This is a philosophical angle. We will come down and look at the practical angle. What it means, action in inaction and inaction in action. Okay. We end with a prayer. Vasudeva sutam devam kansa chadura mardanam devaki paramanandam krishnam vande jagat guru. Thank you.